SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, and SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D video journal, is pleased to present in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, another in the series of Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds, held on the first Sunday of each month. The general title of the Grand Rounds is Global Solutions to Clinical Challenges in Neurosurgery. The moderators are Estrada Bernard and James Ausman. The title of this presentation is Challenges in Instrumental Decision-Making in Lumbar Degenerative Spine Disease. Using a case presentation on failed back surgery with a global discussion of the management of these problems. Professor Samuel Ohegbaum was the neurosurgeon in chief and is the founder of Memphis Hospital for Neurosurgery and Other Specialties and the CEO of that institution. He's the first president of the African Federation of Neurosurgical Societies and was at the University of Nigeria as professor, dean, and deputy vice chancellor. All of this is in Enugu, Nigeria. Other people involved in this talk are Dr. Okwundulo, who is a neurosurgeon at Memphis Hospital, Professor M. Budususi, also at Memphis Hospital, and Dr. Diogolo.
Sam, we start with your group. I know Dr. O had already started sharing his screen and did a good check and to make sure that it was working. So Dr. O, please proceed. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the presentation.
Distinguished colleagues, last month we started our presentation and time was against us, so the second half of it had to be postponed. We're back on stage today to continue the discussion we started last month. Spine surgery is a major part of our practice in Nigeria. And as I said earlier, it forms about 27% of our workload in our center. And we encounter, obviously, problems and complications. And instrumentation is one of the areas that seen again.
Sam, I missed. You said it was what?
Can you still hear me?
Yes. Sam, you said it was what percent of the workload you had? I missed
37%.
37. So one out of three cases are spine cases. Are they mostly trauma or are they're just regular?
Very mixed. Some trauma, a lot of spine tumors, but degenerative spine disease is now the dominant component of spine surgery.
Interesting.
Yes. So today we are going to continue the discussion we started by presenting two cases to illustrate some of the problems we encounter with instrumentation, and Okwi will take off with the presentations. Thank you very much.
Good evening from Nigeria. My name is Dr. Okwundulo, consultant neurosurgeon from Memphis Hospital in Southeast Nigeria. Today we'll be discussing two cases of decision making in spine surgery. We'll start with one on the lumbar degenerative spine disease. Our topic here, we're tackling challenges in instrumentation decision making in lumbar degenerative spine disease. A case presentation on failed back. Thank you. This is the Memphis Hospital for Neurosurgery in Nigeria. This is the hospital, part of the hospital compound. We are presenting from Southeast Nigeria, Enugu State, as can be seen elucidated part of Nigerian map. As a way of background, spine surgery is on the increase with changing trends in sub-Saharan Africa. However, decision making in instrumented lumbar derivative spine surgery can be quite challenging. Variations in surgical decision making for the lumbar spine depend on the specific clinical scenario, surgeon's training, the experience, and even geography. There's little consensus on either the precise indications or prevalence factors for any specific therapy. Typical indications for instrumented lumbar spine surgery include abnormal motion between two lumbar vertebrae, aberrant spinal alignment such as spondylolisthesis, or painful motion segment, which can be discogenic, facet mediated, or both. It is thought that elimination of these pain generators by instrumentation would afford symptomatic pain relief. However, that doesn't happen in all cases. It's hard to suggest that as the complexity of spinal surgery increases, the risk of payback surgery also increases. The success rate of revision surgeries also decreases with the number of revision surgeries. About 50% of spinal surgeries may be successful when performed for the first time. This success rate keeps dropping from 30%, 50%, 5% for the second, third, and fourth revisions, respectively. Payback surgery syndrome is a generalized term that is often used to describe the condition where lower back pain persists or appears after spine surgery. We present a 76-year-old retired senior police officer who came to the clinic with 2 years history of recurrent low back pain. Low back pain was insidious in onset with progressively increasing intensity with a visual analog score of 8 over 10. There was a regular pain that related down both feet. Back pain was same as aggravated pain in severity. There was a significant neurogenic claudication, upper limb weakness with clumsiness, paresthesia, and numbness. He also had all the incontinence and constipation. His low back pain, however, dated back 18 years prior to presentation, leading to lumbar pedicle fusion in India in 2017. He was relieved for some months before the recurrence of symptoms. However, in 2021, he had posterior cervical decompression, thoracic decompression, and revision of lumbar surgery in India due to progression of symptoms. He had post-operative left upper limb weakness, which improved after the surgery. However, since after the second surgery, which included C3 to T7 limited laminectomy, T8 to T10 laminectomy, and L3 to L5 revision decompression, the low back pain progressively worsened, with regular pain down both feet, worse on the left. General examination, he was an actual elderly man who was not in any of your painful distress. He was not pale, FFI, was not dehydrated, there was no fetal edema. Vascular signs were quite unremarkable. Second level system examination revealed the DCS of 15, higher central and cerebral functions were intact. There was no abnormality of the cranial nerve. The neck was supple. Both examination review reduced muscle bulk, globally normal tone in both upper and lower limbs. Power was 5 over 5 in all in upper limb muscle groups. The power on lower limb was essentially 4 plus across all myotones. The deep tendon reflexes were brisk on the left. Ankle clonus was absent and plantar response was flexor bilateral. Sensation was intact, scoping prick, joint position sense and abdominal sense were all preserved. The back showed healed midline cervical scar, midline thoracic scar, and healed lumbar scar with slight tenderness at the lumbar spine. The chest and abdominal examination were essentially normal. Preoperative radiology, lumbosacral, he had a lumbosacral MRI, which showed hollow sign suggestive of losing implant screws. Also, the CT also showed losing L5 screws bilateral. This is the MRI of the patient, the lumbar MRI, showing the L1 to L5 pedicle screws with hollow sign. The first is the T1, second is the T2 image, showing intact canal. This is the CT of the patient, showing the L1 to L5 pedicle screws with same movement that is noted on the MRI. This is cervical MRI of the patient, showing good enough space for available for the spinal cord. With some element of scoliosis. The axial view showed normal space available for the cord. We had laboratory tests as workup for surgery, which was essentially normal. We also had chest X-ray and ECG. The working diagnosis was failed back surgery with implant failure and infection. We had revision implant surgery under GA with L1 to L5 pedicle screw revision and fixation with posterior fusion with hydrogen appetite. Interoperative findings included a midline lumbar scar, previous transfacetal screws, membranes around screws and rods, distorted facets and parts around rods. He had loose locking screws, that is the cap screws on L5 bilateral. This is the post-op image of the patient showing the good trajectory of the screws from L1 to L5. This is the sagittal image, the coronal image of the same patient showing good trajectory of the screw. Immediate postoperative period was uneventful and he was managed in the ward. The drain was removed on the 3rd postoperative. He had corrections for post-op anemia, hypoalbuminemia, this electrolytemia, and delayed brain healing. He was on antibiotics, analgesics, and hematinics, as well as anticoagulants for DVT prophylaxis. He also had wound care for surgical site infection, less secondary wound closure with subsequent improvement. Present symptoms did not, however, improve despite regular physiotherapy and clinical psychologist input. He was subsequently discharged home on the 5th week post-surgery for outpatient follow-up. Post-op virtual review done for him, a distant virtual review, 3 months post-op. He still has significant low back pain, limited mobility, and dissatisfaction with outcome of surgery. What are the challenges? Decision-making for surgery or conservative approach in failed back syndrome is quite a challenge, whether to go ahead and operate them when the patients are presenting with failed back surgery, especially when they have had multiple surgeries. Like in this index case, I've had multiple surgeries in India. And in the second surgery, we had both cervical, thoracic, and lumbar in one city. That was quite amazing. Then surgery is indicated in the index case because of implant failure and infection. Despite multidisciplinary care with psychotherapists, physiotherapists, and neurologists, we could not meet patients' expectations. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation.
End of the presentation on this case of failed back surgery is quite a big challenge for us. When we when we have patients that have done a lot of spine surgery and keep presenting with challenges, in this case, because of the implant failure as well as infection, we have to do another revision surgery for the patient. However, the patient is still unsatisfied. And we have been seeing the discussion on the decision to instrument in some of these cases of low back pain. We all know that we don't know which surgeon did it in India, the first surgeon, we don't know whether it's orthopedic or neurosurgeons. It is known that orthopedic surgeons are more likely to fix more segments than neurosurgeons. Neurosurgeons are a bit more on the conservative side. However, whatever it is, both of us are involved in the management of low back pain and spinal instrumentation. Therein lies the essence of this discussion, challenges in instrumentation, when to fix, when not to fix, and when to stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's always disappointing when we don't have the outcomes that we desire. I wondered about the status of the infection. Did you identify the organism causing the infection, and on subsequent follow-up, did the CRP go back into normal range, and do you have indication that the infection was resolved?
Maybe you didn't hear your question.
Sorry, I can't hear.
Did you hear me?
Okay.
Yes, it's better now. We can hear.
Okay. So I was asking the status of the infection. Did you identify the microorganism? And well, I'm going to add another question. How long was your antibiotic treatment? And do you have indication that the infection was resolved? Did the CRP
no,
go back?
No. All right. Thank you. Can you hear me? Can I be heard audibly?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes. Actually, the patient had been on antibiotics before we saw the patient. Had been on antibiotics. So that was why the CRP was a bit borderline. And then we decided to go in with the aim of doing source control. But when we got in, we didn't have much evidence for infection again. That is why we decided to remove the screws and place another set of screws intraoperative.
I think Alvin's got a question.
Alvin, hello? Dr. Doe, please go ahead. What's your question?
Thank you very much. And this case is almost what us in Liberia will see frequently. So I just have a question. Thank you for that brilliant presentation, Dr. O. So my question is, was there any need for intraoperative upon when you change your screws, when you were placing the screws? Some surgeons usually use vancomycin powder to place while placing those new screws. So I don't know whether that was done also.
Okay, thank you for that. Yes, we don't have a vancomycin and powder. What we did is thorough irrigation, and then when we place our screws, we try to use povidone iodine and irrigation to do source control also for the patient.
Okay. So you place the povidone. So what that solution we call betadine here, so you place that into the irrigation and irrigate the field with that?
We use it to irrigate the wound. But there was not any active infection going on. We didn't notice any pulse. I think the antibiotics have been on had cleared. That is why we went ahead to instrument. If there was active infection, what we normally do is to remove all the implants and then irrigate the wound and come out and follow the patient up with antibiotics until CRP is normalized before we consider going back again.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, I'd like to ask one. Jay, good morning. The presenting symptoms on the, Dr. O, what were the presenting symptoms on the case? I missed that. Was it just back pain, or was it back pain and infection? I missed that.
It was just back pain. Just back pain, radicular back pain with a radicular component. He's been on for some time since he had the first surgery. He had some relief a bit over 17 years ago. Then he had second surgery about 5 years ago. The pain persisted, even became worse after the second surgery. So he presented to us and we had to do some images for him, and we saw noticed that he was having some loosened screws, especially on the L5 pedicle screws. So we did a CRP, which was borderline. I think he had taken some antibiotics. So we proceeded to do wound exploration for him. And when we got in, we discovered there was no active infection going on, but the INI screws on L5 were already loosened bilaterally. And some of the screws were already loose, and then the whole construct was not rigid. So we decided to remove all the screws and use bigger size screws to fix the patient. Bigger size screws.
Could you put the, I think some people just joined us, could you put the images of her, of the spine back up with this? And maybe that might help everybody. So he had bitch back pain. And do you know, while you're doing that, why was he operated on previously? Why was he fused? What was the problem?
Yes, it was the same back pain. It was the same back pain that took him to India. Because of the back pain, they evaluated him and felt he needed fixation. So they did L1 to L5 pedicle screw fixation for him in India. That was about 17 years ago, been a long time. However, five years back, the pain recurred, and then pain was even worse this time. He went back and they did revision fixation for him. And he, despite the revision fixation, pain persisted. And in the second surgery, he had both cervical, thoracic, and lumbar. Virtually all the regions were operated, you know, with only the lumbar spine being the revision case. Despite that, he still did not get benefit for the surgery. He still complained of back pain, and that progressed until he presented to us.
Are there any questions for people? Cargill, you heard the case to begin with. What's your thoughts about it? This is a very complicated problem he's dealing with. I mean, they're at the end of the the train line with everybody doing surgery beforehand, handling him, man, with back pain. That's really complicated. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I guess my, when we see these patients with multiple surgeries and still with back pain, we sometimes pause a bit just to try to confirm that the pain is in fact related to some anatomic problem, you know, be it the infection or axial pain or a non-fusion. Because if not, some of these patients may actually benefit from non-surgical treatment. There's been a new paper that came out a couple of years ago that showed some benefit of high frequency spinal cord stimulation for back pain in a small select group of patients with failed back syndrome. So I would certainly consider, I don't know if that technology is available widely in Nigeria, but that's one thing that we would consider. Send them to a pain management specialist to see if there may be some non-operative treatment available, unless you can clearly identify a reason for the pain. If it's non-fusion, flexion extension views show that the fusion didn't take, then it makes sense to go ahead and revise. If, there's an ongoing infection, treat that medically. But that's the one thing that I would kind of throw into the mix is the non-surgical treatment of if it was just purely back pain.
Go ahead, Jim.
How does everybody treat infection in spine with previous implants? Is that a reasonable question, Strata?
Well, I think that's a good question. And now I was just going to ask or raise the prospect of a partially treated infection. And so it in a situation like this is important to do an intraoperative culture and follow up on it and then make your adjustments with antibiotic management based on that. Then the other thing is whether this could be an indolent infection that doesn't manifest with gross purulence, but could be something like staph epidermiditis that could present like that. Those are a couple of things I would be concerned about. And then the other issue is I think there was mention of using hydroxyapatite. Is that correct, Dr. O? Did you use hydroxyapatite and just the concern about
an infection.
Yeah.
Yes. We need to address the appetite because the patient's bone, just to get posterolateral fusion, patient has already had extensive laminectomy, so we didn't want to take more bone from the patient. So we had to use hydroxy appetite. Actually, in trial, we didn't see any active evidence of infection, unless maybe perhaps like you said, an indolent infection. There was no active evidence of infection. That's why we decided to use hydroxy appetite to achieve posterolateral fusion for the patient.
Did you obtain intraoperative cultures?
Yes, we did, but it was sterile because patient had taken antibiotics.
Okay.
Wow. Jay, did you hear about case, Jay?
Dr. Morgan, you're muted right now, but please comment.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. Sorry, I was on call, so I'm getting in a little bit late. Dr. O, did you fuse down to L5-S1?
No.
And did you
do L1 to L5?
Did you do any medial branch blocks to see whether L5-S1 might be the source of pain?
No, we did not.
Because that's one source. And another source that I found in patients that I've treated a long time and haven't been able to figure out their pain source is SI joints. So L5-S1, oftentimes, if you have a long fusion segment above that area, will give you pain. And in addition, you may get some pain from the SI joints, which may not be diagnosed. And I used to not believe in SI joint fusion, but it's been very helpful in some patients who have some chronic low back pain. Just my thoughts from seeing those films.
Okay. Nim, do you see a lot of spine cases and do they see a lot in Kenya?
Thanks very much. Why don't I get Dr. Michael Magoha? Dr. Magoha is in this call, and he's the one who is currently in charge of the residence where I used to be. Dr. Magoha, are you able to make a comment?
Sorry, just a point of clarification. I missed the last question.
Mm.
It was about use of antibiotics or well, what was available?
The issue here, basically, we're just discussing spinal instrumentation, the relevance of spinal instrumentation in sub-Saharan Africa and the challenges we face, especially in issues of infection following the spinal instrumentation and whether we should remove the implants when instrumentation occurs. And maybe what you could comment is how often do we do spinal instrumentation and the challenges we face on spinal instrumentation in our setup, and the fact that, you know, patients have to buy the implants so before we do the surgeries, and basically that takes a bit of time. We share this work with our orthopedic colleagues, and probably I would say our orthopedic colleagues maybe do most of this work more than us. But maybe Dr. Magoha, you could just give a general outline. And I also notice in this call, there are quite a number of my colleagues from Nairobi or from Kenya who could also give their views about this. Thank you.
Thank you for the chance to comment, Professor. I think you've mentioned it. The first thing to note is we have about two or three suppliers with wildly varying price ranges. We don't have the companies here specifically, but we have brokers for them. On a lighter note, instrumentation is one of the higher charged things, and we think that might have something to do with taxation of the instrumentation itself. As Professor Mwambe has said, at the Kenyatta National Hospital, the spine discipline is divided into two. And it is true, orthopedics does take the bulk of the instrumentation. However, for many what we call quote-unquote complex instrumentations, we do them either in concert or alone. We do most of the upper cervical procedures. With regards to instrumentation, all of the things are available locally. I need to be clear, all the way from artificial discs to self-retaining plates, holding cages are available, so we have a wide gamut. In the public hospital, we do get some subsidies and we stick with most of the traditional or older implants. So just traditional plates and screws are available. In the private sector, like I said, we can go all the way up. So the residents can attest, and I'm sure my colleagues can attest, that we have to keep following up with the trainings, about one to two a year. And we do have a link via the university with OA through the Department of Surgery. Sorry, with AO, sorry, through the Department of Surgery. So through that, we are part of the Middle East and Africa region, and we do have regular trainings with the students. So we are improving. Everything is available, but standardization is not, is the short answer. That's to answer part number two. Part number one, regarding changing instrumentation dependent on infection, I would say it would depend on the degree of infection. For things like acute osteomyelitis, if stability is maintained within the spine, there's no migration or movement to the spine, loosening of the screws, then that is fine. We don't really remove most of the time. We also have access to things like bone cement. If you have a transient infection and you find that the construct is a bit loose, depending on the type of construction we're doing, you might just go back in and inject some bone cement there, make sure that it holds, use some fluoroscopy to check, so you don't normally have to review the whole construct. That's a small comment that I would give. In immunocompromised patients, we do completely review the constructs. I think it's a long question, but I think that's the shortest answer I could give. I defer to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Okay. What about Dr. Ben Mutiso? Dr. Mutiso is the one who presented last week, and he works at the Armed Forces Hospitals. Dr. Mutiso, are you able to give your comments on this, please?
or Sam. Sam.
Thank you, Professor, for this opportunity to share. We do quite a number of spine surgery, and I would say for degenerative spine, and especially lumbar, which is the topic of discussion today. The rate at which we do fusion and the rate at which we do not do fusion will probably be 50-50. And therefore, we also see the complications that come with fusion, like presented here, are also quite common. And some of them include infection. I think which is more prevalent in this part of the world. But in terms of instrumentation, I think we are able to do the whole spectrum that involves the lumbar spine stabilization. I think this would be my comments on this. And this, I think, is a very relevant discussion for us. Because the more, I think we are doing more and more spine surgeries, and therefore we are also seeing more complications as we go on. And therefore this will help us to at least make better decisions for the patients. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thank
you very much. Ali, you had a comment,
yes,
or a question?
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning and good afternoon, everybody. Since it's the topic of the spine, I just want to share something that happened in United States. About 150 patients were instrumented for the back injury or spine injury, and the instrumentation came from East Asia, and they were all fake, and they were broken screws, broken, all the metals they used. And FBI got involved, and apparently the hospitals, to make a cheap deal, they got these instruments from these companies outside the United States. And believe it or not, 150 patients are suffering, and those surgeons and the hospitals were investigated. The only comment I have for you, don't let these groups to sell the fake instruments for your patient in Africa. Unfortunately, there are bad people around the world, and they don't care for the patient. Since you are doing such a great job to save the life of the patient, please don't let these fake instruments to come to your country and Africa. That's the only comment I have. And thank you very much for all this presentation.
I think Michael has got a question, Estrada.
Yes, please, Dr. McGaugh.
Thank you so much. I want to associate myself with the comments of the previous speaker. I agree with you, Professor. That adds one of the issues we have with working locally due to the lack of standardization. And since it's the brokers, it behooves the surgeon themselves to study the implants and decide the one that we can use. Interestingly, what you said is sometimes we have an issue of understanding. Patients might just want to pay for the most expensive, even though it's not. So it just adds a new dimension. So, and we don't get this during training specifically. Afterwards, we have to do exactly what you're doing, the due diligence. And that happens about every 6 to 8 months, unless you get a favored broker who has been working for a long period of time. And that, of course, has a cost implement. But thank you for highlighting that.
Excellent.
Thank you, Dr. McGaugh. I had another comment, and it's been in the back of my mind. You know, in this case, there was quite a number of years since the previous surgery, and it raises the question of an indolent infection, and specifically about Propionibacterium acnes, which can be very slow and can be difficult to isolate. Sometimes you just have to watch the cultures for quite some time. So, I just wanted to make mention of that prospect.
Dr. Kaba, what's your thoughts from your country? Do you see a lot of spine surgery? Is this a common problem you see? Dr. Kaba, Samuel Kaba.
Yeah, we virtually do the same as in Nigeria. And we see a lot of trauma, especially spine. We do a lot of instrumentation. The first thing I would just, the beginning, I wanted to ask a question to know how the patient is faring now. That is the most important thing for me. How is the patient faring and the strategies?
I think he said he's still having back pain.
He said that he was still not satisfied and had persistent low back pain.
Alvin, you said you see these cases. What do you do?
Sorry, I just had a general question to the presenter and to all of us.
Please go ahead.
Supposing that this case had been performed via minimal invasive surgery for the first time, what would have been the way forward? Go in again, remove the screws via minimal invasive surgery, and go in again, do the same, or we would have done open surgery? Just for those who have experience with that.
Yes, thank you very much for that question. I think minimally invasive spine surgery, well, it's fairly minimal. Sometimes when patient has had minimally invasive spine surgery and still comes with failed back surgery, I think it's better to convert to open. Because sometimes minimally invasive spine may not be able to address some of the challenges involved in the pain generators that are noted in the spine. So maybe better to convert to open surgery if you have this case. Especially when you're dealing with infection, you need to do source control and all that. You need to do thorough washout. I think it may be better to convert to open if this patient has had a minimally invasive spine surgery previously. I don't have experience with that, but that is what I feel.
Alvin, you mentioned a little bit about seeing this in your country. How do you treat it?
Well, thank you. So most often, I usually discuss with my mentors from Ghana, and at times we usually manage them conservatively. And if there are some cases that we need screws remover, we need to identify what kind of screws were used, which mark, and I usually discuss with some of my mentors from Ghana. But I have a question. If there was no infection regarding the failed back syndrome, is there a role for epidural steroid injection that is going via the sacral horn, going through the sacral open, the sacral hiatus for that? Because I was just going through the images, looking at, I think there is the instrumentation from L1 to L5. L5. So is there a role in the absence of infection?
Yes, there is a role for conservative management, spine injection, especially when there is no infection. There is a role for that because the more you operate, studies have shown that the more you operate, the less likelihood of a good outcome. So it may be worthwhile to consider all those spinal injections in order to achieve pain relief. So there's a very big role here.
Yeah, I just one comment. I would be cautious about epidural steroid injection in chronic pain. I think the data is that
for spine injection,
for acute back pain, epidural steroid injections might be effective 50% of the time, and half of those can be attributed to placebo effects. So for chronic low back pain, I'd be cautious about epidural steroid injection. Dr. Alien brought up the prospect of spinal cord stimulation. I wanted to ask the neurosurgeons in Africa, what is the status of spinal cord stimulation in Africa? Is that a viable option? I know those devices can be quite expensive, but so is spinal instrumentation.
Yes, thank you for the question. The status of spinal cord stimulation in our country now, especially in Nigeria, is there's no much place for it now. It's what we read about in the books, what we see when we travel abroad. But for now, we don't do spinal cord stimulation for low back pain. It's not a very big technology. I just think the challenge might be the cost and the willingness of the neurosurgery community to imbibe newer means of managing low back pain. So for now, we're not doing it. I don't think there's any center in Nigeria that does spinal cord stimulation.
Well, thank you for that. What are the experiences elsewhere? Ghana, Kenya?
Well, in Kenya, what I think we need to appreciate that spinal cord stimulation comes with the specialty itself. It's a pain management and functional neurosurgery. Now, those are aspects of neurosurgery which haven't really developed very much in Kenya. So pain management at the current moment, majority of it is really done by our colleague in anesthesia. And spinal cord stimulation in Kenya, we haven't at all really established that, you know, as a form of management in, like, let's say, these patients with failed back surgery syndrome. We haven't really established that. But as I said, it's because areas that specialty of pain management and functional surgery hasn't developed very much in this part of the world. I know. I was in Cape Town last year, and it's now when it's starting to pick up. So if areas like Cape Town, which have been very, very well developed as far as neurosurgery is concerned, it's only like, let's say, the last 5 years, or, you know, when they've started picking that area of functional neurosurgery and pain management, then, you know, areas like Kenya, which, you know, we're very, very much behind as far as South Africa is concerned, you know, this will take a bit of time for us before we reach that level. Thank you.
Thank you.
Olo, how do you treat this in the Congo?
Well, I don't think it will be very much different in DRC, in Congo, because, in terms of neurosurgery, you know, they are relatively, you know, coming up now. So it's hardly, I think they're still, they're in their infancy stages.
Did you have
just to make a comment on this. Unfortunately, when it comes to this stimulation issue and DBS, we really have a serious situation within the continent. I have personally engaged Medtronic when it comes to DBS and spinal cord stimulation, and the cost implication is quite alarming. Mm-hmm. And the forms that I had to fill were so many, and then the number of specialists they were searching, from neurosurgery, from neurology, from the programmers, from the physiotherapy. I mean, especially when you look at the conditions, there were too many. We have only been able to try one case, and even that, getting the items from South Africa was a trouble, because they said they were not the items that have been formally approved by the FDA. So we had to use different means. Talk to the FDA, but single case, you can't use that. But the cost implication is one of the issues. And then the development of other specialties, especially neurologists, and this in the facility. So there is a long way to go.
Sam, did you have one more case, or is this the case that you want
to... thank you. I was going to draw attention to that we had the second case to present.
Yeah, let's do that.
I don't know whether there's still time for that. If there is, then we can proceed with that. I was hoping now this discussion will take place after we presented the two cases, because the theme was for the same thing, the problem of instrumentation in the continent.
Okay, Sam, let's go ahead and do that presentation, and let's okay. Be expeditious about it.
Are you there?
Yes, Prof.
Please get on with it. Thank you. By the way, the name on the screen is not the person. Okui is the person presenting, but I'm seeing Akwada on the screen.
There we go. Okay.
Just for the...
While he's doing that, I'd say the first case you presented, Sam, was complicated. What we've seen is it's complicated everywhere in the world.
Yes.
You're treating backwards, which is difficult in the first place, and the second place, it's, I mean, there's no proof for anything. And so it's really a difficult, very difficult.
Well, he's a 33-year-old right now, man, who presented with mess of all four limbs, 3 days of three days duration. He was passing by an uncompleted build when a block of a concrete block fell from an uncompleted building and fell on his head. He fell and realized he could not move his lower limbs. He was initially moved to a private hospital where he had initial resuscitation before he came to our hospital. On assessment, he was assessed as a case of complete cervical spinal cord injury with C6 and neurologic level. And he came on the fourth day of surgery. The MRI showed spinal cord edema up to C2, CCC7 spondylolisthesis with traumatic disc rupture, posterior ligament hyperintensity. CT also corroborated the same. We rushed to do surgery for him on the fourth day following trauma. He had ACDF with influence with the Robinson technique. And then after ACDF, he was extubated and sent to the ICU. One day post-op, he developed.
Can we see the images? Can we see the images, please, of this patient?
Yeah, I thought I was giving a summary. I thought I was giving a summary, sorry. All right, this is the image of the patient. This is the pre-op images. This is CT showing C6-C7 spinal cord injury. The other one is the 3D image. This is the spinal MRI showing C6-C7 traumatic disc rupture and then ascending cord edema, cord contusion with posterior ligament hyperintensity, as well as cord compression at that level. There was also ascending and descending cord edema. Diagnosis of C6-HIS cervical spine injury with grade 2 until resensis was made. He was admitted into this ICU and managed as per prime protocol. He had C6-C7 emergency ACDF within 15 hours of referral, that is 3 days post injury. Intraop findings included soft tissue swelling, grade 2 C6-C7 after resensis, and loose CFS relatives, disrupted ALL and PL. Intraoperatively, he had inadvertent neck movement and anesthesia, under anesthesia with head strapped. This was, however, promptly controlled by the anesthetist. He was extubated and transferred to the intensive care unit. He had compromised respiration 1 day post-op with decreased air entry bilaterally. ABG showed uncompensated respiratory acidosis with a pH of 7.025, necessitating immediate intubation and mechanical ventilation on SIN below. His post-op recovery was complicated by recurrent chest infection, right tract infection for which he was treated. He also had delayed percutaneous tracheostomy 4 weeks post-op to maintain optimal airway. This is the post-op CT. Showing the ACDF spinal fixation using the zero profile. He remained on SIV mode of mechanical ventilation despite multiple attempts to wean him to the spontaneous mode. About 2 weeks post-op, he was noted to have made some improvement by initiating spontaneous ventilation, but was unable to sustain it over a considerable period. The patient and relatives were counseled about the ventilator-dependent status of the patient. On family request, he was, and due to financial constraints, was referred to another national facility. He had open feeding gastrostomy done 7 weeks post-op to facilitate feeding. His current neurologic level is C4, with GCS of 15 and intact higher cerebral functions. He's currently 7 months on mechanical ventilator and has failed all repeated attempts at weaning. What are the management challenges, long-term mechanical ventilation, and poor prospects for weaning in complete traumatic spinal cord injury with neurologic level of at C4 in a young man? Then early versus late surgery. For late surgery, have given time for us to stabilize this patient and possibly avoid ascending and descending and for the edema. Our learning points here, we could have delayed, given the cord edema that we noted that was up to C2, we could have delayed more to intervene in this patient, allowing this patient to stabilize. Then key adrenal anesthesia to avoid more secondary spinal cord injury during intubation and surgery. To avoid and aggressively manage chest infections and consider early tracheostomy despite ACDF wound, which when indicated or anticipated. Thank you. So our challenge here is a young man who is fully conscious, has been ventilator dependent for upwards of 7 months following complete spinal cord injury with fixation done on day 4 of surgery. Now, in sub-Saharan Africa, it's a big challenge maintaining patients on a ventilator. I don't know what occurs elsewhere. I'm sure it's going to be a problem all over the world. This is the seventh month. He is fully conscious. High cerebral functions are intact, but we are still having a problem getting him off the ventilator. And his neurologic level still remains C4. Initially, it was C6, but it ascended to C4. That herein lies the challenge in managing this patient. So we want the international faculty to make some contributions and see how we can make some progress in managing this patient that is tasking our resources. Thank you.
Thank you. So this is a challenging problem anywhere. I think the greatest prognostic indicator was that he was ASIA A on presentation. And you made mention of the MRI scan. And I think you said that there was already indication of edema ascending up to C2 at that time. So I think regardless of the timing of surgery, you probably would have had that evolution over a few days. I remember when I was in residency training in the 80s, we operated on people with cervical spine injury in the middle of the night, as soon as possible, emergently. And the thought was that it didn't make much of a difference. So there was more of an approach of delaying surgery. And now the pendulum has been swinging back to doing early surgery again, with some indication being that early surgery may make a difference with neurologic outcome. But the problem is, in this case, is that the patient was ASIA A on presentation, I think.
Jay Morgan, do you have any thoughts about this case?
I would agree with Estrada. I think the other thing is that the patient presented, it seems like, 3 days after the injury. So you're getting to him after, if there is a time to get to him immediately, that's kind of passed, and that's, you know, not physician mediated. So I think this is just one of those sad cases, and these things happen. Certainly we've all seen it. And it looked like on the MRI scan, the edema was all the way up to C2 already. So whatever happened after his injury or with his injury, he had extensive core edema, and this is, you know, probably patient disease.
I agree. This is Dr. Allen. I think, you know, timing probably won't make any difference here, given how extensive the injury is. I do have one question, and the question is, was there any attempt to correct? It looks like he had a spondylolisthesis, maybe a perch facet or junk facet. I'm just wondering if there was any attempt to reduce that intraoperatively or not.
Yes, we did attempt. We used Gardner-Webb traction. We used Gardner-Webb traction to try and reduce it, but that was the best we could get. Converted it from grade 2 to grade 1.
Thank you.
Yeah, that can be the challenge with these cases, especially if there's a fracture of the facet joint, that an anterior approach may not be sufficient to fully reduce the deformity. My preference has always been to do it anteriorly if I can, and would even do a manipulation under anesthesia to get a reduction. But if that's not feasible, then bite the bullet and flip the patient over and do a posterior approach to effect the reduction before stabilization.
Well, I, Sam, you presented two almost impossible cases, which are impossible everywhere in the world. And I don't think anybody has any suggestions to do it any differently or better than you did. One is distressed to see this because you can't do much to help them. The back pain is a terrible problem everywhere. And the question is, if is it a is the back pain. And this man looks like he was okay for a number of years until he had the surgery, the first case. But is it a failed, instead of a failed back surgery, is it a failed surgeon's decision process? So these are very complicated cases. I don't think we have any bright ideas for you, Sam.
Yeah, thank you. So there's a question that Ali put in the chat asking about whether traction was used intraoperatively. I know there was mention of Gardner-Wells tongues being placed and traction being used. Was that maintained throughout the case?
The traction. Yes, traction was maintained throughout the case to achieve reduction, but we couldn't reduce more than converting grade 2 to grade 1. We had to fix it at that level. No, traction was used.
Okay, is there any other discussion? Because we should go on to Cargill's presentation, I think.
Yes.
Sam, thank you very much. Those are all the three cases you presented last week and this week. They're extremely challenging problems, very difficult, and nobody's got any better ideas than you got, so you're doing great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, the group from Memphis Hospital in Nigeria.
We hope you've enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit and to help us improve our programming in the future. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Please send your questions, comments, or requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. And remember, there are many ways to learn. Surgical Neurology International, SNI, is edited by Nancy Epstein, is a 2D internet journal. And the second is a video journal of neurosurgery, 3D video journal of neurosurgery with interactive with discussion. The web address of SNI is sni.global. The web address of SNI Digital is snidigital.org. All these publications are free to everyone everywhere, 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 territories since 2010. It's the third largest readership in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations and Learning was begun 8 months ago. It is now seen in 141 countries. It is an all-new video neurosurgery journal. The goal of the foundation supporting these journals and this program is to help people throughout the world. In addition, some of this material may appear on Medical News Network in an effort to bring truthful medical and science news to the world. The program is copyrighted in 2024 by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, which is an IRS USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. All rights are reserved. Thank you very much for watching the program. We hope you've enjoyed it.